Alors, je souhaite la grande bienvenue à tous. A welcome to everyone. Je voulais juste dire en premier qu'on a de la traduction simultanée aujourd'hui. Alors, s'il y en a qui... La plupart des présentations seront en anglais. Alors, si vous voulez la traduction simultanée, de juste aller à l'arrière de la salle, il y a les choses qu'on a besoin pour la traduction. Just to mention to everyone, there is simultaneous translation today, and the presentations will be in English, but questions are welcome from the floor in either French or English, and so if there are French questions and you'd like to understand them and you think you'd like a translation headset, please just go to the back and pick one up. So, and I just wanted to mention as well that you may have seen, but we have a team of volunteers here with yellow badges and an accessibility desk. So if there's any needs at all during the day, please just go to one of those people. Juste pour mentionner qu'on a une équipe de bénévoles aujourd'hui, on peut les identifier, ils ont les petites choses de nom en jaune. Alors, de juste leur mentionner si on peut vous aider d'une façon. So just quickly, we have two co-chairs today, two wonderful co-chairs. I just wanted to quickly introduce them and pass it on to them to get the day started. Jody Hyman is founding director of the McGill Institute for Health and Social Policy and principal investigator of the World Policy Analysis Center. And Michael Stein is executive director of the Harvard Law School Project on Disability and Cabell Research Professor at the William and Mary School of Law.
Thank you, Jen. Welcome, everybody. It's just fantastic to see you all here. I'm sorry, actually, while getting the door, she stepped outside instead of in. Jen Proudfoot, together with Talia Bronstein, are really largely responsible for organizing this. So before I delve into a proper welcome, please do thank them both for me. So this week, I celebrated my 25th anniversary. Wedding anniversary. I was able to talk to both of my sons on the telephone. One of them is at college at Cornell. Another one is teaching in the South Bronx in one of the poorest schools in the United States. I rode my bike. I went to the grocery store. And you might be wondering why I'm telling you about my week. I also, by the way, and this is important for a conference on work, had the enormous pleasure of working with my colleagues at the Institute for Health and Social Policy, which I direct at McGill. It sounds pretty boring, I know, and many of us have kids or have friends who, if we told them about a week like that, would say, get a life. Where's the music? Where's the dancing? Where's something exciting about that? Here's the thing, though. In my grandparents' time, none of the basics that most people take for granted, the ability to marry, the ability to have and raise children, the chance to find a job, even the chance to walk freely around as I did, could be taken for granted for people like me. They all would have been threatened because of something most of us didn't realize when we were born, which is that we were different. Or at least perceived as different. So in the United States, there had been not just legal discrimination, but even criminalization of living with epilepsy. So in 1895, sounds like a long time ago, just a little over 100 years ago, Connecticut, advanced state that was, passed a law making it a crime for people with epilepsy to live as husband and wife if the wife was younger than 45 years old. Now, okay, I'm not going to go there about what it says about attitude towards women who are over 45 years old, which I'm counted among them. Small wonder that Ida McKinley, who was the first lady of the United States before this, 1897 to 1901, kept her seizures a secret, or that many people hid them. Because most states actually followed what Connecticut did, one after another. They criminalized marriage, and some states decided that wasn't enough, and they mandated surgical sterilization of people with epilepsy, criminals, and others they didn't want to reproduce. Well, now, the United States wasn't alone in this. Sweden, for example, in the 1920s, because we often think of the Nordic countries as having every policy right, and there's much to laud about what's going on there, but some problems like bias and framing of differences does pervade the world. Sweden prohibited marriages of those suffering with what was then called venereal disease or epilepsy. Marriage Acts in India stated that marriage could only be solemnized, quote, if at the time of marriage neither party suffers from recurrent attacks of insanity or epilepsy. This law wasn't changed till 1999. Again, I'm not going to go into what that says about attitudes towards mental health. But the pattern around epilepsy was actually pretty persistent around the world. The United Kingdom didn't repeal its last law forbidding marriage for people with epilepsy until 1970. And in fact, at the time my parents were married, and I tell you that to say how much change can happen in a generation, the time my parents were married in the United States, 17 out of the 50 states still forbade getting married if you had seizures. So evidently, by the way, trying to limit this proliferation by sterilization and banning marriage wasn't enough. The United States also banned entry. So you couldn't immigrate to the United States from the early 1900s until 1965. There were laws restricting it if you had epilepsy. Now, that wasn't all. There were public places you couldn't go to, and that availability, knowledge that you could legally go to all public places, even if you had seizures, doesn't change until the really great civil rights changes around the Americans with Disabilities Act and other acts like it that preceded it around public spaces. Now, it wasn't just the laws. The public opinion polls were not very reassuring either. So up until the mid-1900s, so when many of us in this room were born, it was still the case in the United States that more than half of Americans thought people with epilepsy shouldn't work. So I probably should have been clued into this when a colleague, a prominent public intellectual, at the time I was at Harvard, I was public about the fact that I had seizures, and he was warning me against. And he confided in me that he had seizures, but he didn't want anybody to know. He was pretty clear why he didn't want anyone to know. He was worried people would think he knew less, he had less good ideas, that he couldn't understand things as well if they figured that out. And once you hear the history of the laws and read the polls of what many people believed, I guess that shouldn't be a surprise. The reason I wanted to start with this story, though, is that there has been an amazing transformation. It's a transformation for one condition. There are many successful stories that we're going to hear through the day, as well as many ongoing problems we're going to hear through the day. But it is an amazing transformation for one condition in a few settings. And the battle is far from won. But at least by the time I graduated from college, 9 out of 10 Americans no longer thought that epilepsy was, quote, a form of insanity. I'm not sure who wrote this poll and what they were thinking about at the time about either epilepsy or mental health, but clearly there had been a change. And maybe they asked this question because it wasn't until the 90s that the Vatican changed its rules about exorcism for epilepsy. So clearly there still remains a great deal to be done. But in many settings now, what was seen as a condition that was so disabling as to mean that people shouldn't be in public spaces, they shouldn't be in schools, they shouldn't be working, they shouldn't be marrying, they shouldn't have kids. Even the Supreme Court in the United States has written that those attitudes really were a social construction of disability. Dramatic that they came that far around on it. That is not yet the case around the whole world. 90% of people with epilepsy live in low and middle income countries, and in most of those countries, they still are not getting treatment. And it's certainly not the case, as we know, for work across the whole range of conditions that people live with to get categorized as a disability. So in the OECD, just over 40% of people living with disabilities are employed, compared to 75% of people who aren't living with them. The numbers are far less than half in Japan, Peru, South Africa, and elsewhere. The challenges are different in different countries. The challenges to education, leading up to having the skills available to work, the challenges of having, whether it's the health care one needs or the support services or the accessibility to be able to work, and the challenges in the workplace itself differ, and they differ by the range of conditions people live with. We won't be able to address all of it in one day, but we hope to touch on many of these. And my real hope is that a generation from now, somebody else is standing at the podium and telling the story of many other conditions that right now we, with the way we construct society, make it difficult or impossible in too many places to live full and meaningful lives, and that has been totally transformed, and that there are as many people in the audience who are stunned that it was ever as bad as it is today, as I think many of us are stunned when we hear the statistics about epilepsy. So I'm deeply grateful that you're all spending the day with us. I can't wait to hear and learn from everybody who's going to talk, whether they're at the podium or whether they're in the audience here, sharing with us your stories of what's working, of what the challenges you're facing are, and how we can all work together to try to transform conditions. Thank you very much for being here with us.
Good morning. Jody is always a very difficult speaker to follow, but this morning she warned me she'd be especially challenging to follow. My job, since I will be doing some of the closing remarks, is to welcome you, to introduce our keynotes, and to get out of the way. Very often when we speak of disability and employment, we frame it in terms of negatives and the challenges and the barriers and the deep prejudice, and there's a lot to that. We could all tell stories about it, either from our personal experiences or otherwise. I could tell you a funny one if you like. Interviewing for a law professor job and going from room to room with various schools, I ran into the room of one law professor, and it was just a single woman who was there. Usually you have 1 to 6 people interviewing you. And she's actually renowned as a feminist, which I think is very notable, because the people who often profess to be liberal and progressive when it comes to disability sometimes kind of forget to be liberal and progressive in that manner. And she said, "How are you?" And I said, "I'm fine." She said, "Well, how are you doing going back and forth with all these interviews?" And I said, "I was fine." And she said, "Well, you know, it's a long way between rooms. This is a very large hotel. It's got 3 buildings and all that." And I said, "Yes, I know that." She said, would you, I know that you've taken half-hour breaks in your schedule, and I have no one next period. Would you like to lie down? Because I was in her hotel room. And I said, excuse me? And she said, well, you know, would you like to take off your jacket and lie down and have a rest? I said, I'm sorry. I'm here to interview for a law professor's job, but are you asking me to remove some of my clothing and lie down on the bed? And she was aghast. She said, oh, no, I didn't mean that. And I said, oh, okay, let me understand. You're not sexually harassing me. You're discriminating against me on the basis of disability. And I tell that story with some joy and pleasure, because whenever I go back to the law professor's annual meeting, of course, I sneak up on her in the lobby and say, you know, hey, Ann, how are you? How are you feeling? Do you need a rest? I've got a room upstairs. But I also tell that story because I understand, working in many, many parts of the developing world, just how privileged and how lucky and how fortunate I am. And I could tell very different stories, for example, about, you know, being in Dhaka with one of my colleagues, and he's the first person with a disability to be allowed a driver's license in Bangladesh. And he's driving me around. He's very proud that he could drive. And we come to a street corner, and all the beggars come up to us, and they all have visible disabilities of one sort or another. And usually you just pretend that they're not human, because otherwise you want to take off your watch and your wallet and your passport and everything else and distribute it to them. And normally he would do the same. He would just look ahead, but instead one came up to the window and scratched on it, and he opened the window. And I was wondering, what's this about? And as he opened the window, the fellow who's on a crutch and is wearing very dirty clothes leaned in and said, Professor Stein, thank you so much for your talk yesterday. I gave a talk to about 200 people. He said, it's really inspiring for us. We appreciate it. Here's a man with a university education, a disability advocate working in Bangladesh, who, for reasons of cultural prejudice, stigma, etc., finds it more expedient to beg at a street corner in Dhaka than to have formal employment. So I understand the context, and I know that everyone here has stories, both personally and those that they have observed, and we all know the purpose of employment. But we also, although we frame it in terms of stigma and exclusion, there's also a wealth of opportunity and a world of good practices and progress. And one of the reasons that I'm so very delighted that we're doing this conference together and the volume that will follow is that we focus on what works and how can we move forward and how can we engage each other, work with each other, facilitate, create networks, and try to improve things. We won't solve everything. We won't come up with answers. There are answers, but there is not the answer. But I know that we will learn from each other, and I'm so very excited and enthused about it. So for the thank yous, thank you to Jody. Among the very many great privileges of being an academic are that you get to choose the projects you work on and the people you get to work with. And being invited to co-chair on a project you care about with a friend who is brilliant and supportive and just plain fun is terrific, so thank you. Thank you to all the IHSP fellows and staff and volunteers. None of us would be here today without them, and in particular, Jen, thank you for your extreme kindness. And thank you to Gonzalo for allowing me as well to co-edit the volume. I'm very excited about that coming out.